turn with me to 1 Samuel as we continue our study through this book of 1 Samuel, chapter 4, again today. It is part 2 of our entire chapter of 1 Samuel, chapter 4. Would you stand with me, please, as we hear the word of the Lord? 1 Samuel 4, verse 1. And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to do battle against the Philistines. They encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Aphek. The Philistines drew up in a line against Israel, and when the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. And when the people came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh and brought from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. As soon as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout so that the earth resounded. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shouting, they said, "What does this great shouting in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" And when they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come to the camp, the Philistines were afraid. For they said, "A God has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us. Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews, as they have been to you. Be men and fight." So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and they fled, every man to his home. And there was a very great slaughter, for 30,000 foot soldiers of Israel fell. And the Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. A man of Benjamin ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh the same day, with his clothes torn and with dirt on his head. When he arrived, Eli was sitting on his seat by the road watching, for his heart trembled for the Ark of God. And when the man came into the city and told the news, all the city cried out. When Eli heard the sound of the outcry, he said, "What is this uproar?" And then the man hurried and came and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were set so that he could not see. And the man said to Eli, "I am he who has come from the battle. I fled from the battle today." And he said, "How did it go, my son?" He who brought the news answered and said, "Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there has also been a great defeat among the people. Your two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured." As soon as he mentioned the Ark of God, Eli fell over backward from his seat by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died, for the man was old and heavy. He had judged Israel 40 years. Now his daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant, about to give birth. And when she heard the news that the Ark of God was captured, and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed and gave birth, for her pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the women attending her said to her, "Do not be afraid, for you have borne a son." But she did not answer or pay attention. And she named the child Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel, because the Ark of God had been captured, and because of her father-in-law and her husband." And she said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the Ark of God has been captured." And may the Lord add his blessings to the reading of the word, and you may be seated. I begin this morning by asking a simple question. Where's the glory? Where's the glory? It's a strange question to ask in these particular days, because we are really not too familiar with this word, glory, and we're going to take a look at it biblically before the morning's up. But just generally, we ask ourselves, where is the glory? And that's how the ending of 1 Samuel chapter 4 is going to end, saying that it has disappeared from Israel. And specifically, the glory of God has disappeared. But if we back up, and I am going to try by the end of the message to define what glory actually is for my own purposes. I've been studying it this week, and so hopefully I can express what the glory of God actually is. But glory generally, it's high renown. If we talk about glory, it's high renown. It's honor. It's magnificence. It's the best thing about whatever you're talking about. You look around our country today, and it seems that the glory is leaving our country, it seems. Now, once again, don't take this too biblically yet, but the glory itself of this amazing country just seems to be fading away. And so often, as I began to think about it this week, I noticed in my own mind and thought about times of glory and how, as time goes by, it just seems to fade. Some of us have individual glory that we pursue, that it has to do specifically with us or it has to do with our family, but I glory in certain things. Some people seem to fight as they get older, and I'm finding when you turn into your 60s, you just don't want to fight anymore for the glory of being 20 and 30 and doing what you did back in those particular times, but the glory seems to fade, and yet there are those people which want to hold on to that glory into their 80s and 90s and 100-year-old, and it's just like it catches up, folks. And glory just seems to fade. And so the question then is, as you begin to think about it this morning, the question you have to ask yourself and I have to ask myself, where is the glory for you? Where is the glory for me? What is it that truly matters that I pursue the magnificence of it, the honor, the renown that goes with it? Is it within my relationships? Is my family my glory? And keep in mind, it should be. It should ultimate glory. You're going to see where it's going to lie, but we look at that. We say, you know, I can glory in my family. I love what's going on in the midst of that. I love what's going on in the midst of my relationships, and I see great magnificence within those. But they're fleeting. All of that is fleeting to some degree when we compare it to the glory of God, as we will this morning. And so we turn ourselves to the story found here in 1 Samuel chapter 4, and it's going to be Israel's experience here, specifically with one of their arch enemies, the Philistines. Now, last week we saw the first half of the message down to verse 11, where the defeat had occurred in battle between the Philistines and the Israelites. And amazingly, what has happened in the midst of that they have suffered a phenomenal defeat, twice, as a matter of fact. Now, whether or not literally we know the number of thousands have been defined for us here, we've got to be a little bit careful, but we know that 30,000 people have fallen at the second battle. First battle, 4,000 people fall. 30,000, this is a major, major defeat for the nation of Israel to one of their archenemies. And we looked last week at the lesson that was intertwined within that passage, and it has to do specifically with God keeping his promise. If you remember chapter 2 and chapter 3, and we saw the promise that God had said, because of the sin of Hophni and Phinehas, because of the sins of the priest, and the fact that their father failed to take action that he should have and to protect the integrity of all of God's commandments and God's way of salvation, that there was great judgment coming upon this family. We saw that in chapter 2, God's promised. And then the vision to Samuel, which basically in chapter 3 said, hey Eli, that promise that God said that judgment was coming is now upon you. And so that's the setting of this whole chapter that we've seen, because verse 1 begins, and the word of Samuel came to all of Israel. Well, what was that word? Not just his general word, but it was the word of the judgment that was coming upon this family and, in essence, coming upon Israel itself. The nation of Israel had seen, at least last week and in the battle prior, their major concern was the power of God. We saw last week, if you want to listen to last week's message, it's online. But we looked at that, didn't we? And we looked at the fact that the nation of Israel thought they could somehow harness the power of God for their own discretion and for their own ways. And so they wanted the Ark of the Covenant, which was the very expressed tangible evidence of God's promise and covenant to his people, and his very presence was found in this Ark of the Covenant. And so they assumed that they could harness the power of God, take it into battle, and they could defeat the Philistines. Well, we saw the power of God exercised, didn't we? A great defeat has occurred. 30,000 Israelites lay dead. That was the power of God. And so we see the nation of Israel thinking that somehow we can harness God's power. And God says, I'm going to use my power against you, my people. I'm going to be using it against you. And there's nothing you can do when God's power is being used against us. There is nothing. That was the lesson that we saw last week. We have to be very careful with the idea of saying that simply I can call upon God for any whim that I may have. I can simply quote some verses. I can simply pray harder. I can simply attend church. I can have my own personal devotions. I can do anything that would replicate to me an Ark of the Covenant, that somehow I can harness God's power by doing this. And so we cannot do that. And so now we pick this story up in the latter part of chapter 4, where the news of the disaster is now coming back to Shiloh. It's coming back home. It has just occurred, and we're going to see two basic settings. We're going to see Eli, the priest, and he's going to be told about the defeat. And then we're going to see a little more intimate setting where the wife of Phinehas, of one of the priests, decadent brothers, one of their wives who is about to give birth, we see her also finding out the news and the significance of what she says has occurred here. And so we have those two scenes that we want to look at this morning. So begin with me, and right at the beginning in verse 12, and we read this, that a man of Benjamin ran from, that's the tribe of Benjamin, ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh the same day with his clothes torn and with dirt on his head. Now, we kind of see this from the perspective of the city right now. The narrator writes it from the perspective of the city, that if you'd been in the city and you can kind of picture this, here comes a guy running from the battle. He's of the tribe of Benjamin, which is going to play into something later on. It's amazing. Sometimes we think that the writers of Scripture use kind of superfluous words, just kind of throw in there or whatever. Well, why would we care about this guy being from the tribe of Benjamin? You're going to see that in a couple of chapters, when another member of the tribe of Benjamin, the hopes and the dreams of Israel is going to be pinned upon him, and it's going to be Saul himself. You're going to see how that is going to play in there a little bit. But for now, he's simply a man of Benjamin. He comes running from the battle scene, and he wants to describe the crushing defeat. As he approaches the city, you have to notice his appearance here. Once again, scriptures don't waste words. And so you take a look at his appearance, and I believe that it actually speaks volumes to us. The guy's clothes are torn. The Hebrews wording of this, that dirt is upon his head, the picture that would be painted to the Hebrews is much more than simply a disheveled look. Simply like, did I just get you out of bed? You know how that occurs. You know, somebody tapping on the door and slept in that day, and have that disheveled look. It's much, much more than that. There is clear, visible signs on this guy's appearance that there is mourning and grief going on when he comes running back. He is bringing bad news. You can almost picture tears streaming down this guy's face. That's the picture. If you read it in the original language, this was the picture that you would have seen. Not simply a little bit of dirt on him and his clothes are a little out of it. No, this guy has an amazing picture of dread about him. And we can kind of guess what he's about to say had we been there, just based upon his appearance. But then we switch real quick. When he arrived, we switch our perspective a little bit. And when he arrived, Eli was sitting on his seat by the road watching. Now, if you remember, Eli has changed since chapter 1 in our view of Eli. The first time we meet him, I believe it's in verse 9, where he says, Eli the priest is sitting by the doorpost at the temple. And so we see him described in a much better light, that he is a priest, he's sitting where he's supposed to be. He's by the temple, and we've seen progressively Eli heading down wrong path. And here we just have him, Eli. Eli is sitting on his seat by the road watching. And once again, it's a little bit difficult when we look at the specific text, because I looked at a couple of the commentaries this week, and it does look a little bit different. Your version may even read a little bit different today. It can simply say that here's Eli sitting by the road watching. It could say that he is beside the gate watching the road. And some commentators actually believe that this gate may have been somewhat of a bigger structure, almost, like many of the cities would have had during those particular times. And he would have been watching, and it would have been typical then of actually being on top of that gate, watching, that type of sense. But once again, the man's blind. And so we have to be somewhat careful saying and taking this too far. But in the whole context of this, the story that is being told here, we simply see an old man, 98-year-old, old man, trembling by the gate as he is waiting for news. He's not really watching, obviously, because of the fact that he is blind. But he's trembling. So what is Eli trembling about? His heart was trembling. Continuing on, look at his emotional state in the next verse. His heart was trembling on account of the Ark of God. What's he so upset about? After all, Philistines trembled, didn't they? Didn't we see just earlier that they were terrified when they heard that cry go up into the camp of Israel? That the Philistines were terrified about that? What did it mean? We also see this, the feeling, if you will, the elation, the joyful confidence that the Israelites had when before they went into the battle, and that ark arrives, there's a great cheer goes up. Hey, it's here. Our power is here. And so there's something going on in Eli's life for him to tremble in his heart about this, that neither the Philistines or the Israelites have recognized, that both the Philistines and the Israelites are going to be mistaken about the Ark of Covenant of God to begin with when it goes into that battle. But now we see Eli, the priest, even though he's not called that right here, it's Eli the priest, and he is trembling about that. What's he shaken up about? What Eli knew was what we have seen in chapter 2 and in chapter 3, that God had made a promise, and he knew that God keeps his promises. And that promise was a promise of judgment upon his family. If you remember that that message a few weeks ago, whenever we looked at that, that there was an amazing judgment coming, given to him by another prophet that came and said, God has found your family wanting. Your boys have great disdain and contempt for the way of salvation that he has given. Your boys are going to die on the same day. You are going to die. The fact, the privilege of you being involved in what, as the priest coming in and out of your family, that's going to be removed from your family. He knew there was great judgment coming. He knew that. And he also knew that according to the vision that Samuel had just had, that that day had arrived, and it was coming very shortly. And so he sees this ark going out. Now, I don't believe that he was so upset because of the holiness of the ark, because of all that it represented, very the glory of God itself. I believe that he was upset because he realized that ark was that covenant, promise-keeping God's symbol to them, and it was gone. He knew all of the facts leading up to this. And he knew that his sons, the degenerates, Hophni and Phinehas, carried this ark into battle. I believe what he was trembling about was he knew that punishment was coming. If you take all of the text and put it all together, I believe that's what he was trembling about. The Israelites should have known it, right? And the word of Samuel came to all Israel, according to verse 1. They all knew it. This had spread throughout the nation that God's judgment was coming. They all knew it. They should have known it. And they should have known that they were trifling at this particular point with the very power of God. But they seem to have forgotten that. Not Eli. He did not forget it. And so he is amazingly worried about this, and he's trembling. So what's the city's response based upon chapter 13? Right, once again, when leave Eli, run back to this guy from the city's perspective. He seems to run right past Eli. Once again, we don't know that specifically, but just the way that it's set up, he seems to have run past this blind guy. He runs into the city, and he tells his story. Now, we aren't told what he tells in that city, what he tells, how his story goes. We know what it is. We see the ending of the story. We also know the beginning of it from the narrator's perspective. But it says, and when the man came into the city and told the news, all the city cried out. He barely had to speak. The people would have seen him and seen his demeanor and seen the way he looked at that particular time. He didn't need to tell a whole lot, but he did. And there's an amazing cry that goes up from the city. It reminds us once again of that mighty shout Israel had had earlier, doesn't it? Before the battle, the great cry goes up. It's here. Our power is here. The great cry that the Philistines heard. It's reminiscent now, this city of Shiloh, these Israelites in Shiloh, they're crying out, but they're crying out for an absolutely different reason. And so now back to Eli, and he hears that. He hears this cry from the city itself, and he wants to know what it's all about. So he asks, what's the uproar, according to 14? What's the uproar all about? He wants to talk to this guy directly. Unlike the Philistines who answered their own question, remember, when their uproar went, says, oh, that's that God that led that nation of Israel out from the Egyptians and all those plagues that came about from them. And that God has been with them since that time, 200 years ago, has been with them. And they were amazingly fearful. They answered their own question. We don't see that here. We see Eli wanting to have his greatest suspicions confirmed. Then that man hurried, and he came, and he told Eli. Now, Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were set so they could not see. Now, before, just a couple of verses before, we saw that his sight was failing. If you remember when he was talking with Samuel, it was failing. Now, this had to be fairly quickly afterwards, but there's been a little bit of time progress, because now he is completely blind. He doesn't see anything. Probably the reason that he doesn't see the guy coming down the road and see his condition and the way he is dressed, or the forlorn look that he had, the dreadful news that he was carrying was part of his demeanor at that time. And so it's probably why Eli didn't see that, because he is absolutely blind. We've watched the slow degradation, haven't we, of Eli? Sad story. One of the questions, I believe it was either Table Talks or last week in Refresh, somebody asked the question about Eli and whether or not he was truly one of Abraham's children and in heaven, and that perspective. And once again, I'm not about to answer that question from here. But I have seen an amazing degradation in Eli, how he has gotten worse. A fact which isn't lost in the story of the leadership of Israel. That's what this whole book has been about God's working in true leadership, and what you and I then look for when it comes to leadership, and what you and I then aspire to is in good leadership. But it's not been lost. We've seen Israel, how they have followed right along with their leader Eli and his degradation. We see the people themselves are being drug into that very thing. That's why, of course, this bedraggled guy running into the city isn't obviously recognized. Eli's weak. He hasn't taken care of himself. He's blind. He's trembling at his very heart. This is the picture of the leadership of Israel at this particular time. This is their priest. This is their high priest, if you will. He's not called that, but we can make those assumptions based upon everything that we've seen. What an amazing picture of Eli and the nation of Israel heading to where they have been, and ultimately what you're going to see in the final words of the story today. The glory of God has left Israel. So anyways, Eli gets the news, verse 16 and 17. And once again, when you read it in a text, I had to go back a couple of times, and I don't know Hebrew at all. I have to rely upon my commentaries to it. But it's interesting when you read some of those, the way this would have been said in the original text. He gives it to him in some amazingly agonizing stages, doesn't he? This guy from Benjamin, the tribe from Benjamin had run. And the man said to Eli, I am he who has come from the battle, and I fled from the battle today. He's exhausted. He's stammering on his words. I fled from the battle today. And Eli says, how'd it go, my son? Now, if he could see him, he's probably already sensing. He already knows what I talked about earlier about God's promise. But if he could see him, and he has to hear it in his voice, just think of the dramatic sequence that he gives it to him. He says, he who brought the news, this guy from Benjamin, said, Israel has fled before the Philistines. 200 years these guys have had on and off battles, but they've always been given the promise of God that they will defeat their enemies. And they've fled from the Philistines. Just the opposite of what has been expected by the nation of Israel. Get that Ark of the Covenant here. We got God's power. We'll win. Opposite has happened. The first piece of his news that he gives him. Then he adds, and there's also been a great defeat among the people. There's been a great defeat among the people. That word, that Hebrew word, if you look in 2 Samuel and a couple other places within the Old Testament, basically is the same word that you use for slaughter. It's the same word. This could easily have been explained to him that there is a great slaughter among your people. Among the nation of Israel. This is no minor setback to them. This is huge in what's occurred to the nation of Israel. There has been a great slaughter of your people. Can you hear it in his emotions as he's probably stuttering? Because even within the text, it's, oh, and also, the Israelites have fled before the Philistines. And also, there's been a great slaughter among the people. And also, there's more bad news. It's Hophni and Phinehas, your sons. They're dead. It's exactly as Eli has feared. It's exactly as he knows that God is a God of covenant. God is a God of promise. And when God promised certain things are going to happen, it is going to happen. Now we know why he's trembling. He's been right to tremble over this fact that the Ark of the Covenant has been gone and been used for purposes it was never intended for. We have to be somewhat careful here. Sometimes we have to take care when we see incidents in the Scripture that we make applications that aren't necessarily there. We have to keep in mind that this whole story that we see here is about God's covenant-keeping promises that these people, Hophni and Phinehas, had such great contempt for the way of salvation that God was going to bring the judgment upon them. That's the story here. Just like with Hannah's prayer, we can't make the application that if in the year 2020 you're childless and you want a child, you and your husband want a child so bad that all you have to do is pray Hannah's prayer and claim it and it's going to occur. We can't make that jump. These are unique circumstances. And it's the same way whenever we say, well, he's only worried about the death of two people here, that this guy from Benjamin, that's all he talks about is Hophni and Phinehas. What about the other 30,000 people that are dead out there? Don't they matter? Of course they matter, but it's not the purpose of this story. This is a unique tragedy in Eli's life. The specific word of the Lord had come to him. Eli knew it, and Eli knew that these were signs of God's continuing judgment, that which God had promised was coming to pass. Oh, and one last thing, Eli, one other thing. The Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of God, has been captured. You hear him stuttering, you hear that emotion, you hear that just that kind of continuing escalating in his bad news to him. It seems to me that that's the climactic piece here, that the Ark of God has been taken. What's this going to mean for the nation? What does this mean at this particular point? What does it mean for the nation of Israel? Now, instantly, I believe we see a picture of it happening because of what happens to Eli. Listen to the verses in verse 18. As soon as he mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell over backwards from his seat by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died, for the man was old and is heavy. It's curious. Once again, when you look at the wording from the narrator, it says this. When he mentions that it had been taken, doesn't say specifically, the narrator says, when Eli was aware that the Ark of Covenant had been taken or captured, that's when this occurs. No, as soon as the Ark is mentioned to him. That's how the narrator words this thing. And once again, it just back to that idea, it confirms as soon as the ark is mentioned in Eli's ear, he falls over backward and dies. Because it confirms the promises of God. When God makes a promise and says that if it's judgment or blessing, whatever is coming is coming, it's coming. And so as soon as it's mentioned, that picture in his mind, that was the picture of the covenant, the promise of God, that he knew, this is the beginning of the judgment, and he falls over dead. Now look at his obituary. You know, we write obituaries and people pass away. Usually we speak highly of them in their obituary. And look at our narrator's obituary of Eli having died. He had judged Israel 40 years. That's it. That is all you see as far as the obituary goes for Eli. And there's some irony here. It's amazing. Nowhere within the scriptures do you find Eli ever being referred to as a judge. He's never referred to as a judge. He's a priest. But he's never referred to as a judge in Israel's time. He never said that he is judging Israel either. He isn't called a judge, and he's not used the word. The scriptures aren't saying that he's actually doing the judging. Nowhere do you find it. As a matter of fact, the experience of the judges, if you go back a book, back to the book of Judges, and you actually look through that time frame, all the different judges that God has raised up during that 200-year time frame, listen to what Judges 2:18 says about these guys. Whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and he saved them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. Now, all of a sudden, out of the blue, Eli, his obituary says, and he judged Israel. What an amazing picture of where Israel has come. They are being judged by this inept, old, can do nothing leader. And they use the word, he judged Israel. This is judgment which Israel could have done without, is what we're hearing, with what we're seeing. That God had raised him up, but he hasn't followed the ways that he should have. Especially when it came to allowing what he allowed in the tabernacle at the time. And he judges Israel. It's a commentary not only on Eli's life, but it's a commentary on the nation of Israel. There has been no trust or no proper judgment come from them whatsoever. And so we see the end of Eli. That's it. He judged. And it was a terrible judging of Israel. So now we switch to the second story. And that second story is a little more intimate of a story. We go to the room of Phinehas' wife, who is about to give birth. We don't know her name. We don't even know prior to it. We don't see her prior to this particular story. We don't know this anything about her, but we just know that now this story shifts to that. And there's some deeper insight into this whole lesson for us today here. But we see the news reaching her. Once again, this isn't chronological. It's interesting as I read through the book of 1 Samuel, I want to put every verse chronologically after the one before it. And we can't always do that the way he writes here. So this isn't really a proper chronological sequence because she's basically going to die and then name a child. You have to keep, and this is just an overview of the story. But listen to what it says beginning in verse 19. Now, his daughter-in-law, Eli's daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant and about to give birth. And when she heard the news that the Ark of God was captured, and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed and gave birth, for her pains came upon her. Interesting, when she heard the headline news of the capture of the ark and of Eli's death and of her husband's death, she goes in to labor. Once again, no picture of her trembling ahead of time to this. She has great insight, as you're going to see. But the shock of everything has brought her into the labor, and she bowed and gave birth, for her pains had come upon her. Isn't it amazing, in the midst of all of the deaths that we've seen just in chapter 4, you know, 35,000 deaths plus two of the main, well-known characters, we have at least a birth here, a birth that might be celebrated, but at the same time it's countered with another death. God's judgment is being brought upon them. The women attending her are trying to give her comfort. They're trying to say to her, look at verse 20, and about the time of her death, the woman attending to her said, oh, don't be afraid, for you've borne a son. That's the glory of an Israelite woman, to give birth to a son. And so don't you worry, you've given birth to a son. It didn't mean anything to her. She didn't answer or pay attention, according to verse 20b. The earlier news was too much for her. But this is what she had said prior to her death. This is the gist of the entire lesson. She names the boy, and she names him Ichabod. And her response to the news that the Ark of the Covenant was captured, her father-in-law is dead, her husband is dead, and she can do nothing but name the child. And she names the child Ichabod, saying, the glory has departed from Israel, because the ark of God had been captured, and because of her father-in-law and her husband. And she said, the glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured. Ichabod means, where is the glory? The glory has disappeared. Her proclamation of the significance of that which has occurred here is a far different cry from Hannah's. Remember Hannah's response to God's working in her life? Prayed for the child, child comes. Amazing prayer that we have of confidence in God and the sovereignty of God and thankfulness toward God we saw in that. And here we see this amazing response, which is deeply profound, but just the other side of the spectrum. Where is the glory? Now, the story is far from over, because this just gives us a picture of Israel's history. The glory has departed from Israel. As I began to look at those words, I found something that, whether it's intentional or not, and I believe it is, we are told that Eli was very heavy. Okay. So what? I suppose mechanically, you know, that's going to snap his neck quicker, I suppose. But is there something else going on here where it said he was very heavy? It's interesting. The Greek word for that, for the word heavy, is kabed. The verb form of the word kabod, one letter changed. You know, they're connected words. So he's heavy, kabed, with the word kabod, which is the word glory. And so is there a connection to these? And I believe that there is. I believe what we see here is Eli had been the glory of Israel. He was their high priest. He was the one, probably, argumentatively, I believe, that for years did a good job. But as he got older, he failed to do that good job. And so we see this picture that the glory of Israel had been in this particular person, Eli. He was their priest. He was their mediator. He was their teacher. He was the voice of God to them. He was a representation of the people back to God. The glory of Eli had become no more than a heavy bulk that simply falls over and dies. And then we see that play on those words when it comes to the Hebrew word kabod, saying the glory of Israel had left. And so I believe that it's clear play on words. saying from their time of true glory in Eli, who lays now dead in the street, to the fact that the Ark of the Covenant, where it specifically uses the word kabod, that word for glory of God, has left. The Ark was kept in the tabernacle, if you remember. Always, always has been associated with the glory of God when that Ark was in there. Listen to Exodus chapter 40 in the days of Moses. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, talking about that tabernacle, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the clouds settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. God's glory, His magnificence, His renown, His honor in blazing light filled the tabernacle. That was the picture to Israel. That was the promise to Israel. We are God's people, and He is our God. That's the picture that was seen when it came to this issue of the glory of God. So where's the glory now? It's left Israel, been captured and taken by the Philistines. So as I told the narrative to myself this week, I thought, that's a good narrative. If you're a history buff, that's going to be a pretty good lesson historically. It's a narrative. But where's the application for our lives today? And so I began to think more about this issue of the glory of God and how we have to describe it. And it's one of those words which is nearly impossible to describe. And I want you to think with me a little bit. I have to give John Piper a lot of credit for helping me to understand it this week. He does a comparison of particular words. Glory is one of those words which is very hard to describe. Whereas something much more tangible, something that we can see and describe in certain dimensions or whatever, is easier. So for instance, if I wanted to describe a book, you know, here I have a hymnal, and you had never seen a book before. I'm going to leave that go. We have a wonderful library back there, folks. You need to take advantage of it. But if I was to describe a book to you, I could say it's hard. You kind of thump on it, you can actually hear it. It's kind of hard on the outside. The thing, you know, 7-8 inches around or at the top, and maybe 10-11 inches this particular way, maybe an inch and a half thick. This one's green, and it has some writing on the outside of it. I could describe that to you, and if you happen to see it going out, you'd say, oh, that's a book, because of the description to you. But if I try to describe ugly to you, and I'm not saying the book's ugly, but if I describe ugly to you, how do I describe ugly? You kind of know it when you see it, you know, sort of, I think. And some of you are starting to smile because you have no idea where I'm going with this, and I'm not going where you think I'm going to go with it. I'm just simply going to say, try to describe somebody what ugly is if they have no idea what you're talking about. The book, I can kind of describe to you. It's a tangible thing that you can hold. But there's certain descriptive words that have become very difficult for us to be able to describe. And ugly may be one of those words. Now, I'm not saying that when we talk about the glory of God is simply descriptive, like the word ugly would be. It's nothing tangible. And I'm not going to say that the word glory, when we talk about the glory of God, is something that is intangible, because I believe that it is tangible. I believe it is something that can be seen. But I just wanted to give you that sense that sometimes it's difficult for us to be able to describe what we're talking about when we talk about glory. And so I look at the scriptures. I look at Isaiah chapter 6 and verse 3. Now listen to this. This whole earth is full of God's glory here. And so we're going to compare, like we would being able to compare how to describe a book with the idea of ugliness, not that the two are related, but the difference are there. Here in Isaiah, we see two words that are compared, one being glory, but there's another comparative word that I believe we can describe. And listen to what it is. Isaiah 6:3 says, "And one called to another," talking about angels in the presence of God, "and one called to another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of His holiness," we would anticipate, right? Wouldn't we kind of think that that's what they're talking about? Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is filled with His holiness. It's not what the angel cries. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory. So there's a connection between these two words, His holiness and His glory. And so maybe if we describe His holiness, it might be a little bit easier for us to understand than the word glory, but yet there's a connection to it. We talk about God's holiness. What do we mean? We mean simply this, that God is separate. He is above. He is beyond all, everything, in every category about God and His attribute. His greatness, His worth, His uniqueness is beyond us, even beyond our comprehension as created beings. God is so far set apart. He is perfect in every one of His categories. He's perfect in His perfections. He's perfect in His greatness. He's infinite in His greatness. He's infinite in His worth. Now, you and I may hold a little child up, our firstborn, and say, this is amazingly, infinitely worth this to me, this little baby. Okay, not even close when we compare to the infinite worthiness of God Himself. He's holy. And so we get a sense of things that we can hold to in our lives. But when we talk about God's holiness, whatever that good aspect is that we're talking about, God is in a category far beyond that. There is nobody else even close. He cannot be improved on it. God is determined and made determined within Himself by everything that is within Him, nothing by outside. Everything about His greatness is from within. And so we see this displayed holiness in this. We see the angel crying out, holy, 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 He is beyond all of us, His infinite worth. Here it is. It's God. The whole earth is filled with His glory. And so what I believe that we get to see here is a picture of the glory of God is simply the display of His holiness. It's a manifestation, if you will, of His holiness, of His rightness, of His perfectness in absolutely everything. It is made manifest to it, is put on display to us by His glory. And one of the ways that Scripture does that, I believe Scripture in the Psalms all the way through it, but specifically Psalm 19:1 tells us this, that God shouts at us His glory. He shouts at us His glory. Listen to 19:1. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaim His handiwork. Now, I have been amazed this summer, because I think we have had some of the most beautiful sunsets that I can remember seeing for a long time. I don't know what there is about this particular summer. You Aldertons have been taking pictures and putting them on your Instagram and Facebooks, and it just you see them all the time. And I've just been amazed at how many people, my friends and Facebook, have been putting pictures of the sunset. And each time that I see them, I said, the heavens declare the glory of God. There's a glimpse that we have of the glory of God, the manifestations, the display of the holiness of God, His uniqueness to be able to do that. I believe He shouts that at us within the Scriptures. Go out on a starlit night and take a look, and God will shout His glory to you. But 1 Samuel chapter 4 is this little microcosm, this little picture of Israel and the history of Israel that's going on, that the glory of God has left. It's departed. It was there. Later on, the Assyrians and the Babylonians are going to come in. They're going to drive them out of their land. The special relationship that God has with His people is going to be torn apart because the very glory of God is going to be pulled from them at that time. Not to say that God ever forsakes His people. Not to say that He's left them without any power and without His presence. But this picture of His glory has been taken. So the question becomes then, where's God's glory now? We get a glimpse of it in the horizons. We get a glimpse of it in the sunsets and in the night skies. We get a picture of it. But is that truly the glory of God based upon all the teachings of Scripture? I take us back to our study a couple of years ago in the book of John, John chapter 1, verse 14. Listen to this. And the Word, talking about Jesus, right? Capital W, Logos. The Word became flesh and dwelt amongst us. And we have seen His glory. Glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. The glory of God has come in Jesus Christ. That's what we see. That's this lesson wrapped up in a whole. The glory of God, the manifestations of God's greatness, His holiness, is made manifest to us in the person of Jesus Christ. Listen to what Hebrews 1 verse 3 says. He, Jesus, is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of His nature. And He upholds the universe by the word of His power. Did you hear the beginning of it? He is the radiance of the glory of God. Jesus is the radiance of the glory of God and His exact imprint of His nature. Now, oftentimes when we see the glory talked about in the Old Testament specifically, we talk about this amazing blazing light that filled the tabernacle. We know that when Moses wanted to look upon God, he said, "Oh, now, Moses, you know that can't be, dude. I'm going to hide you in a rock. I'm going to let pass before I'm going to hide you, your face from it, and you can see my backside. You can see my goodness when it comes by, because it's a blazing light." When Moses comes down out of the mount with the law, he's glowing from it. Verily, that the people can hardly look upon him because he's been around the blazing glory of God Himself. You do realize, don't you, that blazing glory is what is going to light us up for all of eternity, physically light us up. There's no need for a sun. There's not going to be need for the moon. Listen to what Revelation says in verse 21, or chapter 21, verse 23. And a city has no need of a sun or moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives its light, and its lamp is the Lamb. That's the glory of God manifested to us. We're not even going to need a sun. I mean, look at it out there today, how bright that is. It's going to be the glory of God that's going to shine upon us for all of eternity. But not yet. It's largely veiled to us today. The glory of God is largely veiled to us today. That's why we get those glimpses. That's why when you look at those sunsets and when you look at those skies, we get a glimpse of the glory of God, because it is veiled to us. But according to Hebrews 1:3, which I just read, Jesus Christ is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of His nature. The fullest picture that we have of God Himself, of the divine nature, of the holiness of God, the closest imprint that we have is the person of Jesus Christ. You study Christ, you study the glory of God. You want to see what it means to understand God's glory. Then you study Christ. When He was here for those 33 years, there was only a short time frame where He was transfigured, where certain of His disciples, Peter, James, and John, were able to get a glimpse of the glory of God. But the rest of those people during that time and the rest of us today, we simply see God veiled in the person of Jesus Christ, because in all reality, we couldn't handle it to see God's glory anything more because of the sin veil and the sin nature by which we live. We couldn't handle it. You know that movie, You Couldn't Handle the Truth? We couldn't handle this. While Jesus obviously was veiled so people could look upon Him and literally live with Him in His humanity, for those 33 years, He exercised certain of those attributes, didn't He, to us? Peace, be still. What happened to the oceans? Whew. Settled down right away. Lazarus, come forth. Death, nothing meant to him. He was able, you saw pictures of the divine attributes of God in Jesus, and yet it was still veiled to you and I. The question then becomes, do we see God's glory today? It departed Israel. And what an outcry that was to this lady, that the glory of God has departed Israel. It is left. So the question becomes, do you and I see the glory of God that is directly in front of us by eyes of faith, by spiritual eyes? When we accept all of Jesus Christ's teaching, when we trust Jesus for all that He has said He's done for us, when we place our faith in Jesus Christ, we begin with spiritual eyes to begin to see the radiance of the glory of God in this person of Jesus Christ. When we read these scriptures, we believe what the scriptures say about Jesus, that He exercised His divine attributes. We're getting a good glimpse. We're just getting a picture of the divine glory of God. John Calvin says this, God is truly and really known in Christ, for He is not His obscure or shadowy image, but His impress, which resembles Him as money, the impress of the die with which it has been stamped. If we want to see something of the glory of God, then we trust Jesus Christ today. We trust Him for all that He is. We place our faith in Him. And as we do, He begins to reveal Himself more and more so that the knowledge of God, which, by the way, Jesus Christ Himself grew in. And if you want to hear that whole study, come to Wednesday night, refresh, as we see Him growing by the indwelling of the Holy Spirit in His life. That He grew in the knowledge of this. If you and I find ourselves in a place where I don't understand this whole glory thing, I really don't. I can see some glorious things in my life, and I understand it from that perspective. But this whole spiritual glory, maybe the question needs to be asked, do I really know Christ? Because He is the exact imprint of the divine glory of God Himself. So those who will be someday with Jesus, we're going to see His glory. We're going to see it completely unfolded for us. But in the meantime, we ask ourselves, where is the glory? Where is the glory for you and me today? Do I see it? Do I experience it in the person of Jesus Christ?